as the School of Music presents the dramatic story of star-crossed lovers Violetta and Alfredo in Verdi's La Traviata. And the Department of Dance showcases the wide range of modern dance in November Playhouse Dance. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, beginning their 10th concert season on Saturday, October 29th at 7:30 p.m. at McKinley Presbyterian Church in Champaign, featuring pianist Ian Hobson and trumpeter Amy Gilreath, and music by Haydn, Beethoven, and Shostakovich, plus an adaptation of Schubert's unfinished 10th Symphony. Information at 355-9077 or at prairieensemble.org.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking with the authors of a new book about Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communist Revolution, a book that had got quite a lot of attention when it was first published in Britain and is now available in the United States. Also a book that's causing a bit of controversy because of some of its conclusions. Our guests, Chinese-born writer Yong Cheng and British historian John Halliday, their book is titled Mao, The Unknown Story. It's just out now and it's published in the United States by Knopf. They are now spending some time here in the United States talking about the book, and this morning they're in Washington, D.C. Among other things, the authors argue that Mao was not particularly driven by idealism, but by a secret desire to make his country the world dominator and to be the leader of it. The authors also say that Mao had a way of getting rid of his opponents by scheming and murder and used terrorism frequently when he needed to, and that he knowingly caused the greatest famine in history. In all, over 70 million people, they argue, died under Mao's rule during peacetime. And this certainly is a figure that has indeed attracted some attention, caused some controversy, because it's much higher than other scholars have said. Other people have argued that indeed Mao was responsible for the deaths of tens of millions of people, 20 million, 30 million. But this is the biggest number, I think, that to date anybody has offered. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guests. Yong Cheng is the author of a book titled Wild Swans, an autobiography about her experiences growing up in China, a book that sold very widely around the world. She was born in Sichuan province in 1952. She was briefly a Red Guard when she was just 14. She also worked as a peasant, as what is called a barefoot doctor. She also was a steel worker. She was an electrician, all of that before becoming an English language student and later an assistant lecturer at Sichuan University. She came to England in 1978 and got her PhD in linguistics from York University in 1982, and she now makes her home in London with John Halliday, who is her husband. He is a former senior visiting research fellow at King's College, University of London. He has written or edited 8 previous books, and his specialty as an historian is the Soviet Union. As I said, they're here spending some time in the United States. This morning they're in Washington, D.C., and they're joining us by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief. And we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, we'll say hello here to our guests. Yong Cheng, hello.
Hello.
And John Halliday, hello.
Hello there, hi.
We appreciate you giving us some of your time very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Perhaps I would ask about what is maybe one of the most dramatic, overarching kind of arguments that you make in the book, and that is that Mao was not a man who was particularly motivated by ideology or by any great commitment to Marxism, but he was indeed driven by this desire to make China the most powerful nation on earth and to be its leader.
Mao wanted to make China into a world-class superpower and dominate the world himself once he took power in China. And before that, as we discovered, he was also driven by power, ever increasing power. And I myself assumed before that Mao was, you know, the young Mao was driven by ideology, by, you know, idealism, his care for the peasants, because he was from a peasant background. But when we combed through Mao's writings and his talks, and we just couldn't find any evidence to support this. And on the contrary, we saw the young Mao, before he joined the Communist Party, saying that it was rich for peasants, it was easy for peasants to get rich, and he didn't think peasants' lives were hard. And in his later years, he was full of sayings like, oh, peasants have only tree leaves to eat, so be it. When he was told the peasants were starving, he said, educate them to eat less. By the way, all this was in writing. I mean, you can find them in, you know, Mao's works published. So that we were sort of forced by evidence to conclude that he was not driven by the idealism of improving peasants' lot in China.
That seems so contrary to the received story about him, about his background, about his feelings about poor farmers in the country, about his feeling that they could be the basis for a revolution, and his way of taking Marxism and changing it and adapting it to China so that that would be possible. Was his feeling about the people, and particularly about the Marxist ideology, simply that was he didn't have any particular commitment to it as an ideology, but simply that it was a tool that he thought could be used to achieve what he wanted to achieve?
Yeah, I think by the time Mao was born in 1893, and the Chinese Communist Party was founded in 1920, and Mao joined it probably at the end of that year. So he was already kind of 26 by the time he you know, became a communist, quite a lukewarm communist. And the Chinese Communist Party was in fact set up by the Russians. And so at the point that Mao, so to speak, shacked up with communism, Marxism, so-called Marxism, was not just the, you know, the thinking and the ideology of Marx as he wrote it, which was partly a tool of analysis, but it was the ideology of, official ideology of the dominant communist state, Russia. And so when you see Mao using word like Marxism early on, it's more like a sort of bludgeon. It's a congenial and convenient weapon with which to bash people he doesn't agree with on the head. I mean, he's constantly saying to other communists, you know, you're un-Marxist, you know, you're a right deviationist or whatever. So it's like it's a sort of bludgeon rather than a tool of analysis.
It seems to be that he is, again, on the conventional story, makes him a key figure in the founding of the Chinese Communist Party. Your argument is that, in fact, that's not the case, or that's not quite the case?
Well, it's not the case. Mao was not a founding member of the Chinese Communist Party, which was founded in 1920 and not 1921, which was the official version. And it was the idea of setting up this party actually came from Moscow. And Moscow contacted their man in China, a Professor Chen in Shanghai, to found this party. Mao was at the right place and at the right time because he was visiting this Professor Chen in 1920. And Mao was a radical then. And Professor Chen gave him a job, which was to open a bookshop in Hunan, Mao's home province, to sell radical literature, including communist literature. And Mao loved books. He was also short of money, so he welcomed this job and set up this bookshop. He was, so to speak, incorporated into the newly founded Chinese Communist Party.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation on our line number 4. Someone listening this morning in Indiana. Let us do that. right here. Hello.
Hello. I guess scholarly-wise, since I don't read Chinese and I wouldn't have the slightest idea of what the secondary literature, let alone the primary literature, has to say, I'd ask the question this way. Since there's been a tremendous amount of criticism, I've been hearing it in various places on NPR and other things, and for someone who is just more or less kept up with China and communism through the regular scholarly channels, newspapers, and certain articles that might appear, what part of your book would you consider unassailable, and what part of the book would you consider perhaps the weakest? And if you think either one of those things are important, I'd like to hear your answer. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well,
of course, you know, we think our entire book is unassailable. I mean, the thing is, we've spent more than 10 years researching this book. We've combed through the archives in Russia, which was done by my husband, who speaks Russian. He spent years working in the Russian archives, which was an absolute treasure trove. And we worked in the, we consulted the archives around the world, including the archives in Albania, you know, when the tiny Albania was China's only ally in the 60s and early 70s. And we interviewed several hundred people around the world. Outside China, virtually everybody who had interesting and important dealings with Mao, and including, you know, George Bush, the senior, Henry Kissinger, in this country, and, you know, the Dalai Lama, Imelda Marcos, of the Shu fame. And in China, we interviewed over 150 of Mao's inner circle, his family members, friends, relatives, the top echelon, his colleagues, widows, his personal staff. We have done exhaustive work. I mean, we of course we think our book is unassailable. We welcome, you know, people to discuss the facts, because we have uncovered so many new things. I mean, we wanted scholars to come up and discuss these new findings with us.
You know, maybe I would ask you about one thing in particular, and that is some people have questioned the number that you come up with for the total number of people who died as a result of his policies. And certainly previous scholars have said this was an astonishingly large number, 20 million, 30 million. The number that you put on it is 70 million, and that I think some people have said, while Mao was everything that, in many ways, was everything that you said he was, and that his policies did indeed lead to the death of tens of millions of people, that the 70 million figure is somehow too big. How do you come up with a number like that?
Well, out of this 70 million, which actually is a very conservative estimate, and I know scholars, I mean Chinese scholars, who have much higher figures. This 70 million, part of it is 38 million who died in the Great Famine between 1958 and 1961. And that is absolutely documented. I think when you mentioned the 30 million, 20 million, you were only thinking about the famine death. I mean, with the death of the famine, our figure is 38 million, and some people have come up with 20 million or 30 million, and many even 40 million. And in mainland China, scholars have said the figure was 40 million and even higher. So that was 38 is from the famine, and 27 from death in the Chinese gulags, through, you know, executions, being worked to death, starved to death, suicide, and so on. We carefully documented all this in our book. And then there were executions, being beaten to death, driven to suicide throughout Mao's 27-year reign. And then that's how we came to the 70 million. And all these figures are carefully documented in our book. With the Cultural Revolution, you know, which happened between 1966 and 1976 for 10 years, and we only gave a very conservative estimate of 3 million. And that 3 million was based on, you know, this sort of what they call the county chronicles. I mean, in China, there were over 2,000 counties. And after Mao died, the counties then got put together what happened in that county. And they came up with these names of the people who died violent death in the county. And that came to about 3 million. I mean, anybody who's been through the Cultural Revolution knew that this figure is very conservative, because this is all just the people with names. I mean, there were also numerous other people who hadn't been calculated. So I think our figure is an extremely conservative one.
Let me ask you further that I think that some people, in the way that they have talked about not so much deliberate purges or the Cultural Revolution, but take a look at, for example, all the people that ultimately died as a result of the Great Leap Forward, have said that that was an example of it could be outright stupidity and foolishness. It could be poor planning, something that was somehow might have been in some way well-intentioned and yet was a bad idea to start. But what it was simply was a bad idea. You're making the argument that, in fact, that Mao knew fully well that as a result of these policies, a lot of people would die, and that he didn't particularly care, that he had a reason to do this. It was connected with his relationship to the Soviets and to his desire to build up China, and that he knowingly sacrificed these people, these millions of people, as a way of getting what he wanted, which was get assistance from Russia to build up China's military strength.
Yes. Well, that's what we discovered through the 10 years of research. And before we did the research, I myself believed that the famine was the result of economic mismanagement and that Mao was no good at economics. I said so in my previous book, Wild Swans. But then, I mean, to my utter astonishment, this wasn't the case. Mao knew these people would die, and he had actually incorporated their death into his policy, which was, as you said, to export food, to export the food that these people were dependent on for survival to Russia to buy nuclear technology, the equipment, and the arms industries for his superpower dream. Mao, when he was, told tens of millions of people had died, Mao just said, you know, for all his projects to take off, half of China may well have to die. And I was very shocked when I learned this. And the thing is, I also thought, like many others, that the tens of millions of deaths forced Mao and made Mao see that his policy didn't work, so he changed his policy in 1962. But as we realized during our research, that this wasn't the case. Mao didn't want to stop. He wanted to carry on and make more tens of millions of people die. And his number two, President Liu Shaoqi, then balked at this prospect of more tens of millions of deaths. And he ambushed Mao at a party conference of 7,000 key party officials. And together, they kind of forced Mao to change his policies. And Mao was furious at being thwarted, and he wanted revenge. And this was why he started the Cultural Revolution a few years later. His primary goal was to revenge against President Liu and the party officials who had forced him to change policies. And this was the reason of the Cultural Revolution. And, of course, to purge these officials and replace them with more heartless slave drivers. And all this we discovered through our research, I mean, to my own astonishment. And Mao was deliberate. I mean, Mao deliberately starved these people to death.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our two guests, and we'll continue. Jung Chang is the author of an international bestseller, her autobiography, Wild Swans. She was born in China in 1952, grew up there, went to England to be educated, and that was in 1978, got her PhD in linguistics there, and now makes her home in London with her husband, John Halliday, who was also her partner on the book Mao, the Unknown Story. He's a former senior visiting research fellow at King's College, the University of London. He's an historian who specializes in the Soviet Union. The book is published here now in the United States by Knopf, and they are spending some time in the United States talking about it, and today they're in Washington, D.C. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Dr. Halliday, were you going to jump in there? Did I interrupt you?
No, you didn't. No.
Well, let me, maybe you might like to, I definitely want to get you into the conversation. And I'm interested, perhaps by virtue of the fact that you're a Soviet scholar, as Jung Chang explained, you were able to look at material that was in Russian, that was in Russian archives, and get some of this material that way. And another big part, and I think a very interesting part of the story, is this sort of tangled relationship between Mao and Stalin and the Soviet Union, and also the Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists, and how, in a sense, they work together in, and perhaps you can talk a little bit about that, particularly the significance of the relationship between the two men, between Mao Zedong and Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, well, I'd say for me the main thing, or the most interesting and surprising thing to discover in the Russian archives, was how early on Stalin spotted Mao. And made sure that Mao was the guy who got to the top of the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, the Russians, as is well known, founded and funded the early Chinese Communist Party. But the myth had been then, the myth put out by Mao was very much that he, Mao, came to power rather against the wishes of the Russians, and that the Russians were backing other people in the Chinese Communist Party. This would be in the 20s and 30s. Now, this turns out to be completely untrue, and we can now document it. I mean, Stalin spotted Mao really in the late 1920s. And then there are two very, very significant incidents, which is in 1932, Mao's colleagues throw him out of power, basically because they can't stand him and he's impossible to work with. And we've found the documents, you know, where the Russians say you absolutely have to work with Mao Zedong, you have to keep him on board, so Mao gets back on board. Then in 1934, the Chinese communists, with Russian advice, it should be said, decide to move up from southeast China to the northwest on what became called the Long March. This, in fact, was not in order to go and fight the Japanese, as the myth is, but to go try and get to a common border with Russia and get arms. But at this point, Mao's colleagues, before the march, they once again try to get rid of Mao. And we got the cables where they cable Moscow and say, would you take Mao to Moscow? They don't say, we can't stand him, because they know Stalin is behind him. But they try very hard to dump him. And there's a couple of cables from Russia saying, no, we won't take him to Moscow. You've absolutely got to stick with this guy, and so on. So one can reconstruct this story now of how Mao, I mean, it's always been a bit of a mystery. You know, Mao he was never popular, even amongst his colleagues. And it's always been a bit of a mystery. How did he get to the top of this formidable machine? And the answer is he only did so because he had this really unwavering backing from Stalin. Stalin, of course, spotted Mao. Stalin was a very, very smart guy. He spotted Mao as the guy the most like himself. And the other thing, just relating back to the issue of peasants and so on that came up earlier, is that we got the document showing that from 1927 onwards, Stalin ordered one can call a military option. I mean, his order was to bring the Chinese communists to power entirely by military means.
Just let me mention one further thing and get into a different area here a little bit. And indeed, it's one of the serious kind of points in the indictment against Mao. And that has to do with the way that he thought about the Japanese and the Japanese invasion of China. I think it is true that to the extent that Mao is still revered today in China, one of the reasons that he would be revered is that he is seen as the winner of the war against Japan. Your argument is, in fact, that he was perfectly happy to have the Japanese there if they would fight against Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists, and in fact that he might have even been happy to divide China with the Japanese as long as the nationalists could be defeated and that he could have part of it.
Yes. Mao, in 1937, when the Japanese invaded China, with great brutality, the Nationalist Army resisted, as is well known, around Shanghai and then at Nanjing, where the Japanese carried out a gigantic massacre. And the general feeling, I mean, amongst the Nationalists with a capital N, and amongst the Communists was, you know, we must do everything we can to resist the Japanese. This invasion is absolutely, you know, was an unbelievably appalling a thing and caused immense suffering. Mao looked at it from a very different point of view, and here, of course, one must credit his long-term strategic vision. Unlike other people, he didn't say to himself, how can we resist the Japanese? He asked himself a completely different question, which was basically, what is in this for me? And the answer to that was, this formidable Japanese force can destroy my domestic rival and enemy, Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalists, for me. I, Mao, will order the communist commanders not to fight the Japanese, let the Japanese crush the Nationalists, and then I, Mao, will be in a much better, or the communists will be in a much better position when eventually this war is over. By the way, Mao had no strategy at all. He not only didn't fight the Japanese, he had no strategy at all for getting the Japanese out of China, other than relying on Stalin. And it, of course, in the end, what happened was Mao had hoped that Stalin might divide China with Japan, as Stalin had divided Poland with the Nazis. But what happened in the end, of course, was that Stalin invaded China in 1945 under the guise of entering the war against Japan at the last minute, and by occupying North China was able to arm and train and protect the Chinese communists so they were in condition to fight the civil war. But it's a complete myth that Mao and the communists it's a complete myth that they resisted the Japanese, and an even greater myth to claim that they led the resistance to the Japanese. And I noticed that the current Chinese communist leadership, just recently this summer on the 60th anniversary of the end of the war, made a very big song and dance of claiming that the Chinese communists had led the resistance to Japan, and were trying to exploit the issue of nationalism and resistance to the Japanese in a way, I mean, which was completely falsifying the historical record.
Well, I have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone listening this morning in Charleston. It's our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes. I want to start with asking about the Western influence. After the bourgeois revolution in Western Europe, you know, roughly in the 16th century, and then their move toward or outside the borders of Western Europe, and the invasion of China, whether it was mercantile or otherwise, and then Admiral Perry in Japan, which upset the whole localized structure the Mandarins in China, and then the Japanese hierarchy of their classes, and mainly, you know, a crust on top of the people. And the response to that, both in Russia and in China and throughout that part of the world, and how that has came, you know, who is the villain in this? You know, I mean, the lady I listened to earlier seemed to indicate and talked about the millions of people who died under Mao, and, of course, all the other stuff about those millions who died under Stalin and around the world. Yet somehow the instigation of all these changes, which when Admiral Perry sailed into the to Japan and then across the land came Westerners to upset the whole of China through the Opium Wars and then the trade and all the other things that occurred, which caused the deaths of many millions of people. And where do you cut through all these historical events and find villains and heroes and such as that? The progress of human society and social intercourse seems, you know, to be whoever favors whatever ideology. Can you address that?
Well, if I may say, the Western sort of presence in China from mid-19th century it's not a Western sort of invasion and division of China. China was not colonized or divided. Westerners had, you know, little pockets in China, what was called the concessions. But they didn't, by and large, they didn't impinge on Chinese lives. I mean, they certainly did not slaughter millions of Chinese, certainly not. In fact, they forced open the doors of China and started trade. And that actually benefited a lot of Chinese, Mao himself included. You know, Mao went to a college which was entirely modeled on the Western education, and even the building was in European style and was called the foreign building by the locals. Deng Xiaoping, you know, this paramount leader after Mao's death, said, I think very rightly, he said, of all the Western, you know, invasion or, you know, carving out little pockets of China, only two Western powers did real damage to China. One was the Japanese. And the Japanese invasion caused some 20 million deaths. And some 95 million homeless. I mean, of course, the untold sufferings to the Chinese. And the other foreign power, said Deng himself, was Russia, including Soviet Russia, because Stalin signed with Mao an unequal treaty, what the Chinese called unequal treaty, which was Mao sold out Chinese national interests to Russia, to the Soviet Union, to Stalin, in the hope that Stalin would help him build a military superpower. I mean, the treaty Mao signed with Stalin in 1950 was so disadvantageous to Chinese interests that after Stalin died, his successor, Khrushchev, took the initiative himself to scramble, to drop those terms. So actually, I don't think the West should be blamed for China's tragedies in the 20th century.
Are there any ways in which you can say China is a better place as a result of Mao's leadership or policies? Did he do anything that was laudable?
No, I can't say that. I think Mao dragged China back. The thing is, I mean, if without Mao, China would have been a much better place. And Mao caused, you know, well over 70 million deaths. He caused the untold suffering and, you know, fear, terror. I mean, Mao did something to the Chinese, which I think few dictators did. And Mao made torture public. I mean, you know, Hitler and Stalin dragged their victims to some dungeons behind steel gates. But Mao made everybody in China see those ghastly scenes. You know, I grew up in China. In the Cultural Revolution, we all saw these horrific denunciation meetings at which the victims were stood in front of a crowd and being abused physically. I mean, that struck fear in everybody's heart. And that wasn't just in the Cultural Revolution. During the land reform, at the initial years of Mao's conquest of China. And the same thing happened in the Chinese villages. And so all the villagers saw people being physically abused, beaten up, some were beaten to death. I mean, the Chinese must be the most traumatized nation in the world under Mao. And economically, Mao didn't improve people's lives. And in the year he died, 1976, the average food intake, according to Chinese official statistics, was lower than in the 1930s. And the average income in China was in the 70s was lower than dirt poor Somalia. I mean, even after, you know, spending every penny in China building military industries, Mao left his military industries in shambles at the year he died. I mean, whatever China has achieved economically today has achieved after Mao died and because he had died.
We have about 15 minutes left, and I would like to mention again the two guests we have this morning with us, Yung Chang and John Halliday. Together, they are authors of a book titled Mao, the Unknown Story. It's published by Knopf, is now available in the United States and has been for a bit in Britain, and as I said, is causing quite a bit of discussion and a little bit of controversy for some of its conclusions. They are now spending some time here in the United States to talk about the book. They're in Washington, D.C. Yung Chang is the author of an international best-selling autobiography, Wild Swans, about her growing up in China. She was born in Sichuan in 1952, educated there and also in Britain. She went to England in 1978, has a PhD in linguistics from York University, and now lives in London with John Halliday, her husband. He is an historian, former senior visiting research fellow at King's College at University of London. He's a specialist in the Soviet Union. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Perhaps I might have you talk a little bit about the Long March. If there is anything that is a key sort of myth about Mao, about his life, about the Chinese Revolution, it is that. About this period in the mid-30s when the Chinese communists were surrounded by the nationalists, and as a way of getting away, they made this long journey, the Long March. Your version of the Long March, what you have turned up about the Long March, is substantially different from the standard story of the Long March.
Yes, it is. Well, I mean, first of all, why the Long March? And of course, it is true there was nationalist military pressure, and the communists were in a bad state where they were. That is down in southeast China. But the key reason for the Long March, which actually the Russians had suggested as a general plan some time before, was to try and get the Chinese armed forces somewhere up to a border or close to a border with Russian-controlled territory so that the Russians could supply them with much better arms and military equipment. That's what the Long March was really about. And that now is documented. The communists pretended that they were going north to fight the Japanese, but they didn't go anywhere near the Japanese. And it's significant that they went to northwest China to try and link up with the Russians, and not northeast China, which is where the Japanese were. The second thing which I mentioned before is that the the Long March was nothing to do with Mao. It wasn't Mao's idea or anything. And in fact, Mao's colleagues tried to leave him behind and asked the Russians to take him off their hands. So it was only because of Russian pressure that Mao was on the Long March at all. And it is true that on the Long March is critical to Mao's rise to power. But I think the main factor that has been left out of that equation is that Mao's colleagues knew by then that Mao was Stalin's choice. And, of course, that gave Mao a very, very strong card to play. And the third thing I would say is just, you know, what was the Long March? It has been portrayed, in effect, its resonance is that is to demonstrate some kind of heroism. It doesn't demonstrate anything to do with, you know, land reforms, economic reforms, or helping people on the way or anything. The core of the myth is heroism. And I'd say the main myth about Mao himself on the Long March is that he walked and trekked these 6,000 miles along with the ordinary soldiers. But we discovered that, in fact, he was carried on a litter. And not only was he, you know, carried on a litter, he wasn't carried because something went wrong. He himself designed this litter specially even before the march set off so that he could lie back. It had a sort of cover. And in fact, later in life, he said to his inner circle, you know, that on the Long March, he had plenty of time on his hands, and that he read a great deal while being carried along by porters and coolies who had a very, very tough time carrying Mao this enormous distance.
Yes, I mean, you know, those porters, because when they climb mountains, the ones at the front couldn't walk, and they had to move on their knees. So when they got to the top of the mountains, their knees would be a mess of, you know, blood and the flesh, you know, skin. And it was a very hard life for them. And, of course, there was another myth about the Long March, which was they fought these heroic battles, like over the Dadu River. But, in fact, at the Dadu River, particularly, there was no battle. And the definitive proof of that was that there was not a single casualty, and not one person was even hurt. And the Red Army did suffer tremendously on the Long March, and actually largely thanks to Mao, because he dragged them on a sort of a trek to avoid, you know, sort of meeting up with a political rival, so he might lose power. And after they met up, Mao sabotaged the Red Army under his rival in order to weaken his political rival within the Communist Party for his own power.
And I think also, and here's another point that I think is interesting, and certainly is the first that I have read of this, is that perhaps one of the reasons, maybe the only reason that the Chinese Communists, the Red Army, survived was that Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the Nationalists, held back. And the reason that he held back was that his son was being held hostage in Russia by Stalin.
Yes, yes, absolutely. We were astonished to discover that. I mean, we studied every day of the Long March, and we realized that Chiang Kai-shek let them go. And we ask ourselves why. And then we realized that Chiang Kai-shek's only blood son and heir, Chiang Ching-kuo, was held hostage in Russia by Stalin. And Chiang Kai-shek was desperate to get his son back. So he sort of did this deal with Stalin to trade the survival of the Red Army for the return of his son. And the Red Army survived, and his son was returned and later became the president of Taiwan after Chiang Kai-shek died in 1975.
Let's talk with another caller here. We have someone listening in Urbana who'd like to join the conversation. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. There are two. One point I'd like to make and then one question. The point is your guests are presenting Mao as theoretically vacuous, basically. And I don't think that's quite correct. I think it's important to remember that before Mao became a Marxist-Leninist, quote-unquote, he was an anarchist. And he was very interested in anarchism, almost went to France to study French anarchism and Rousseau. He'd been very influenced by Rousseau. And I think that what one sees, both in his writings and in some of his actions, I'll make a reference to that in a bit, is that influence, that holding on to kind of an anarchism and yet trying to fit that with some sort of Marxism. Now, if you take a look, for example, at the mass line, his concept of the mass line, which was critical during the Great Cultural Revolution, that very un-Leninist, non-Leninist position would seem to be very much an anarchist position, faith in the people, in the peasantry, which Lenin did not have at all, and thus driven by something more than just an attempt to kill people, but driven by some kind of ideological utopianism, perhaps very mistaken, but nonetheless a reason, an ideological reason, rather than just a desire to kill people, to adopt policies that would kill people. The second point I want to make is that your guest, the gentleman, made reference to some nationalist pressure on the communists, and the discussion of Stalin that he just had was very interesting. But how do you explain the fact that on the orders of Stalin, the Communist Party gave up its arms and that its cadre in Shanghai and some of the other major cities on the coast were slaughtered by Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang? Where does that fit in the narrative that you're presenting? It would seem to be troublesome to fit it into your narrative. I'll hang up and listen
to
you.
All right. Well, thanks for the questions. Either or both of you, Ms. Chiang, Mr. Holliday, you want to respond?
Yeah, right. Thank you for these questions. Just on the first one, the line was a little faint, but I understood the gentleman to be saying that we presented Mao as theoretically vacuous, assuming that's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think Mao was theoretically vacuous, which is I would be very pushed to think of, you know, did Mao say anything at all that is of that one could call theory, and that is of any use to anybody. I certainly can't think of a single thing he said that is of use. And the other thing, another thing I would say is that the way he used theory when he was in power was very much to put out slogans which were often very deceptive, and which people, the minimum issue, if one is talking about theory or philosophy or anything, is that other people should have a right to debate ideas and find out whether there are alternatives and so on. Mao had, you know, shut off all alternatives and made independent thinking, criminalized independent thinking. So if one comes to, you know, I think the gentleman also mentioned something about a kind of ideological utopianism and so on. But in 1923, one of the strongest quotes we found is in 1923, very early on in the party, Mao said, "I don't think communism has got any hope of working in China. The only way it's going to work is if the Russian army brings it in from the north." And that's what, if there's anything one could call Mao Zedong thought, it is that, which is basically communism isn't going to work in China. People don't like it, and the only way it's going to happen in this country is through a Russian invasion. And that is, in fact, how it did come to China. And that isn't a sort of ism. I don't think it's theoretically interesting. It's a sign that Mao didn't think that this ideology that he was backing could get popular support, and it all came down to, in effect, an invasion by a foreign power. But that's not theoretically of any interest at all. And Mao never allowed other people, when he threw out ideas and often crazy, he never allowed other people to discuss them. So I find the whole issue of Mao and theory is really a dead end.
Well, the thing is this: after Mao died, all his books were carefully sorted out. I mean, it was it's a fact that Mao never opened these tomes by Marx and Engels or Lenin or even Stalin. He at most read about half a dozen pamphlets, and he wasn't interested in Marxist theory, and he was interested in this system that suited him and that became his own instrument. And also in the Cultural Revolution, it wasn't Mao was trying to apply anarchy. I mean, Mao loved chaos and destruction. This was something in his character. But as soon as there was some sort of genuine anarchy in China in 1967, Mao immediately clamped it down. The Cultural Revolution was actually very tightly controlled.
I'm sorry to say that we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. I have a caller that we cannot take. My apologies. The book, if you would like to read it, is titled Mao, the Unknown Story. It's published by Knopf, and now it's just coming out in the United States by our guests, Yung Jiang and John Halliday, now spending some time in the United States to talk about the book. They're in Washington, D.C. this morning. Yung Jiang, John Halliday, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and new seasonal dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week. Coming up a little bit later today here on AM 580, Special Counsel Peter Fitzgerald is planning an afternoon news briefing in Washington, D.C., and will be joining National Public Radio for special coverage of the briefing. It is possible that he could announce an indictment or indictments regarding the exposure of covert CIA agent Valerie Plame, a story that now has been roiling Washington and Washington politics for some time. We'll get the latest and have the latest for you coming up today as part of the afternoon magazine. Again, that I think we expect that in the 1 o'clock hour here, 1 o'clock our time. We'll talk with another guest about another subject, talking about health care for Latinos in the next part of Focus 580. Our guest will be Stephen Lopez, professor of clinical psychology at UCLA. First, though, we're going to break for an update on the news and markets. Stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with